This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Sociologist Kathy Jaffray spent most of her career as an academic outsider who writes about cultures that are not her own. She studied artistic communities and creative networks in the South Pacific and written a textbook on social analysis. But recently, she decided to take a different approach and explore a culture that she is familiar with, dive bars. Her debut novel, The Drunken Spelunker's Guide to Plato, is based on her time in grad school at UNC Chapel Hill when she spent a lot of time in dive bars. She even tended bar at the Cave on Franklin Street, and that led her to discover that dive bars are a unique space where time often seems to stand still. Kathy's in town for a reading at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tomorrow at 7 o'clock, but first joins me in the studio, Kathy Jaffray. Welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So you are a sociologist of culture and creativity. What led you to look into this particular part of your own life?
Well, I think as a sociologist, I spend a lot of my time looking as an objective outsider at really interesting communities, but those communities are not my own, and especially because I go to the South Pacific, where people have been investigated by outsiders for centuries now, actually. There's a lot of dynamics there that are somewhat troubling, actually. To tell people's stories for them or instead of them is problematic, and I'm very aware of that, so I thought about that a lot, and I thought about whose story can I really tell where I'm not an outsider? My own. And so that's when I started thinking about I'm going to explore actually my own culture from the point of view of an insider, tell those stories that sometimes don't get told. Insiders don't tend to tell them. But I did.
Well, and of course, our stories change over time.
Of course.
The places that we inhabit and the kind of mental and intellectual spaces that we're occupying as well. So tell us what drew you to this particular, or maybe what you were doing and your attraction to dive bars. And this was while you were in grad school, right?
I was a graduate student at UNC Chapel Hill in the sociology department. And I found I was listening to music. The music in the Triangle area, you may have heard, is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really drawn to the music, and I was hanging out in these bars listening to music. And I found that the people who were in those bars, the people who were hanging out there, the people who worked there, the people who washed dishes, the people who waited tables, the people who tended bar, it was a really wonderful subculture. It was a subculture based on generosity, based on people sharing what they had. And often the people in those worlds are very marginalized or looked down on by the rest of society. You know, we have negative words for them, bar flies, drunks. Those are not positive words usually. But this was a very positive world. It was a world where people really cared about each other, where people took care of each other. It was really a world built on generosity in a way that was not something I saw in the rest of my life.
Though that
time
does connect to your work, because that's something you see,
well, right,
pretty much everywhere else in the world, but in the South Pacific, in cultures that have not been infected by our way of life here in the West.
Absolutely. So that was one of the things, having worked in the South Pacific, where I really was making an argument that the creativity, the reason there was so much creativity, so much artistic production going there, was precisely because they valued generosity so much. So that was certainly in my mind. And led to the formation of this novel.
You know, we were just talking about the prison industrial complex, mass incarceration, and it comes from a kind of generalized anxiety. I mean, this is sort of one of these contributing streams, the sense that my stuff is at risk, and there's
right,
only so much of my stuff, and the more of those people you can put in jail, the
right,
better I'll be able to protect my stuff.
Right.
And so it shouldn't be surprising that a quarter of the world's prison population is right here in the U.S.
Right. And when I teach about the South Pacific to my classes at Colorado College, and I talk about this generosity economy, where it really is based on gift giving, my students have a very hard time understanding that often. And they say to me, the question I get is, but if everyone's giving all the time, don't you end up with nothing? And in fact, exactly the opposite of that is true. You have an enormous abundance because what goes around comes around. It all comes back to you. So everyone actually is very well taken care of in societies of generosity. We tend to see those subcultures as being impoverished without seeing actually the riches in them, the riches of music, the riches of art, the riches of creativity, the riches of the spirit, which are there, which don't get a lot of value in mainstream American society. But I found it in the South Pacific, and I found it in the dive bar cultures in Chapel Hill.
So tell us about the premise of the novel.
So the premise of the novel is I ended up weaving through Plato's allegory of the cave. So in the allegory of the cave, there's a prisoner in the cave who is taken from the cave, a community in the cave, and out into the light. And I didn't actually start the novel thinking that I was going to use that. I started the novel just, I woke up one morning, actually, and the first sentence of the novel was in my head. It sort of came to me in a dream, that very first sentence of the novel. So I wrote it down, and the first chapter of the novel just kind of fell out of me. And it took me about a week to write down the entire first chapter, and then 6 years to write down the rest of it. But it was during that process that the idea of weaving in Greek mythology, bringing in the Platonic philosophy, started to fit in there. Because I think myths, the reason we have myths is because they help us tell our stories. They help explain the world to us. They help us express things that are difficult to express. And so as I was struggling sometimes trying to figure out how to tell this story, the myths, which I'd really enjoyed reading as a child, I really loved Greek mythology, came to me and helped me tell the story. It actually wasn't until I was completely finished with the first draft of the novel that I realized that I had been writing about the allegory of the cave.
And it doesn't hurt that the bar you worked, where you worked, is called the Cave. Iconic bar
in Chapel Hill. It's been there since 1968, but I actually did not realize that connection until I had written the entire first draft of the novel. I thought, oh, look, it's even called the Cave.
All right, so give us a sense of what happens in the novel.
A young woman comes from Appalachia. She comes from somewhere probably in western North Carolina, and she's looking for a new world. She's pretty much on her own. She comes to a place that in the book is called Waterville, and she falls into this community. She's a little lost, and she falls into a community of people who may be considered quite marginalized. But those people help her. They guide her. They take care of her. And she grows and learns from that. So it really is sort of a coming-of-age story. She comes from this place, the cave, but she does find through different experiences, find her way out into what Plato would say, into the light.
Would you read for us?
Sure. I'll start with, this is actually the very first part of the book, and the first sentence I'm going to read is the sentence that came to me in a dream. This was in the days when nighttime used to mean something. At midnight, the television stations all played the Star Spangled Banner, and then went dark until time for the farmer's weather report at dawn. You couldn't go to the grocery store after 9. All the other stores closed at 8. It might be hard to find an open gas station. Last call was taken seriously at all the local bars. People were known to get busted running red lights, trying to make it in time. In Waterville, the only all-night restaurant of any kind was Clyde's Chicken, a brightly lit fried chicken joint that usually had only one thing on the menu, chicken and biscuits. Sometimes a handwritten sign taped up on the wall announced the temporary edition of fried livers and gizzards. I never saw anyone eat them, although I've heard some, such as Stinky, claim to. He felt it gave him an air of distinction. Danny wooed me with a handful of early spring violets and a 2 a.m. trip to Clyde's Chicken. "Are you going to eat the gizzards to impress me?" I asked. "Lord, no," he said, and shuddered.
That is Kathy Jaffré, who is reading from her debut novel, The Drunken Guide, Spelunker's Guide, I should say, to Plato.
Right.
I'll read it again.
It's a toughie.
The Drunken Spelunker's Guide to Plato, and she's going to be reading at the regular bookshop at 7 o'clock, but that's tomorrow night, here with me today. You talked about the fact that you wove myths into this. Persephone and Demeter are integral to this story. Tell us about how they play a part.
Well, I was trying to think about how to write about happiness, because happiness is actually a difficult thing to write about. Tragedy is actually kind of easy to write about, because it's usually tragic events happen to you. So it's eventful, and you can write about the event. But happiness tends to be rather uneventful, and that was a problem for me to figure out, how do you write about kind of nothing happening, but you're happy doing it? And when I find that when I'm really struggling with an intellectual problem, either in my academic work or whatever, that if I take a hot bath, it actually the solution magically comes to me. So if I'm working on...
You sit down in the bath and eureka.
I sit down in the bath and
more
eureka.
More ancient Greek history.
Right. It has a long tradition, the bathtub. And so I was sitting in the bath thinking about, how do I write about happiness? And the story of Persephone and Demeter came to me, and it struck me that the point of that story is not that summer makes us happy, but that when we are happy, we make summer. That's what that story says. When you're happy, when Demeter was happy, when her daughter had been returned to her, it caused summer to happen. And sort of twisting our usual perceptions of things around backwards was something that was very appealing to me. And that was actually the first time I realized that I could use myths to tell this story I was trying to tell. And so then from there, it took off.
Now, significantly, you talk about these myths being these kind of dramatizations of our own story, but they are a narrative form, and they are narratives, ancient narratives, that still resonate with us today. But in the Plato allegory, in the allegory of the cave, you begin to see a distinct break from that. Instead of storytelling, there is a real deep extraction from, right, alienation from the subject. We're going to sit back and think about this. Suppose people really didn't experience reality. Suppose it looked like... So in a way, I mean, that allegory is kind of your problem as a scholar, right? Your objective observer versus kind of how do I tell the story of these people in their own voice.
Right. And so there are two sides to this story, and there are two sides of this problem of being an insider and an outsider, being subjective, being objective. And I think one of the wonderful things about writing a novel as opposed to writing my academic work is that I have a lot of freedom to think about a way of telling deeper truths. There's a truth, and then there's a deeper truth. And for me, what I found was, even though this book started from actually my own personal experiences, the characters did take on lives of their own. And the story did become a different story. And the main character, who it's a first-person narrator, sounds like it might be me, has some elements of me, but makes choices I didn't make, I wouldn't make, does things I didn't do.
And you talk about the trying to reflect some of the happiness and the goodness, the generosity, but you don't romanticize this. There is a darker side. I mean, there is, even if you find generosity in that space, there's a certain amount of destructive behavior that goes on.
Right. And human beings are human beings. None of us are angels. And I think that's one of the things that we have to realize. And one of the things that myths help us to understand is that myths are not about angels. Myths are about human beings. And the Greek gods are actually fascinating in this way, because they're certainly not perfect. They have jealousies. They have pettinesses. They make mistakes. They do things. And I think that's one of the reasons that those ancient myths have survived so long, is because it resonates with our experience as a human being. We can be generous and lovely one moment and selfish and not so lovely the next. That's what being a human being is about.
Well, and that may, again, getting back to our earlier conversation about mass incarceration in those ancient cultures, bringing together the dark side and the light side, and our relationship between inside the cave and out is really the matter for consideration. As we sort of move farther along on this Western track, we really do want to put all the bad out there,
right,
project it onto other people, and then put them in jail. And again, here we are again, instead of integrating kind of some of the behavior that we're not proud of, but, you know, that's who we are.
Right.
We really can't tolerate that well.
And I think that's very interesting that we decide there are bad people and there are good people, and that as a society, if we can just take the bad people and put them away somewhere, then we won't be bothered by them. But one of the things I wanted to integrate in this story is, actually, there aren't bad people and good people. There are people, and they engage in all sorts of behaviors. And depending on the system you're in, a behavior that is really negative in one situation may be really positive in another. So we see people, you know, who stay up all night, who drink a whole lot, but who also make really beautiful music. And, you know, drinking a whole lot is not necessarily a healthy behavior, but it might be very functional in a world where you're trying to wrestle with the soul of creativity. And so we see people in this novel who make decisions, some of which would be considered very upstanding decisions, but in the situation that they're in, it has a negative consequence. Or the flip side of that, we have to see what the situation is before we decide what this behavior means.
So, I mean, imagine living in a culture where hoarding and greed were considered actual vices.
Right.
You'd have to imagine a culture where greed was considered a vice. And then if you were, let's say, the CEO of a corporation that deliberately compromised my respiratory system.
Right.
By putting out cars that actually had higher levels of air pollution.
Right.
And threatened my life and my children. Well, that guy'd go to jail.
Right.
And the guy with drug paraphernalia may or may not.
And so we clearly do not live in that society here in mainstream America, right? People get away with all sorts of behaviors that seem fine, that in other cultures, like in the South Pacific, that would never happen. That would never be allowed to happen.
No, somebody's mother would have slapped him upside of the head before he
even
got
long ago.
To be a real estate guy or a presidential candidate.
Right.
Let me ask you this, though. Has your idea about your work changed as a result of doing – do you look at your work differently now that you've written a novel?
I think it's very interesting because it does – one of the things I look at is creativity. And it does – this whole process has opened me up a lot of things that I have studied as a scholar and seen as a scholar, written about by other scholars and academics. I now have lived, and so I have a real understanding of what it means when, for example, an author says the characters took on a life of their own. They just started doing things. How is that possible? They're coming from your own head. Now I've lived it. It's possible. They just start doing things. They have a life of their own.
Kathy Jaffré is a sociology professor at Colorado College, whose debut novel is The Drunken Spelunker's Guide to Plato. It is loosely based on her time tending bar in Chapel Hill during grad school. Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Kathy's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. If you missed it, check our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Sheldon, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.